Buddhist Summer School, Saturday, 16th August, 1986. I am very happy indeed to see all of you here and to meet so many old friends again. Whilst I am happy to say what I have to say, I hope you will not be sorry to have heard what I say. Now, may all of you have perfect hearing so that you hear my words, which are a poor presentation of truth, of reality, insofar as I have seen it for myself. But if you have perfect hearing, you will also hear, conveyed not through these words, but by the sound of these words, the underlying truth, which is what actually matters. If I knew the Buddha would be speaking here tomorrow, nothing in the world could stop me from going to listen to him. And I would follow him to the very end. What an incomparable teacher the Buddha must have been, that such words were spoken in Ojai by Krishnamurti, the light of the world in the 25th century after the death of the Buddha. You all know that for years and years I have disclaimed the title of teacher, except where teaching school subjects or piano playing is concerned. And even that is now beyond my ability to carry out satisfactorily. 40 years ago, whilst studying the Digha Nikaya, I noted the Buddha's discourse to the Brahman Lohitcha on the question of who was the blameworthy teacher and who was not the blameworthy teacher. The Brahman Lohitcha was well established at Salavatika, a royal domain granted him by King Pasenadi of Kosala, one of the northern kingdoms. When Lohitcha heard that the Buddha, together with 500 monks, on tour through the Kosalan districts, had arrived at Salavatika, he sent an invitation to them to partake of the midday meal on the following day. This invitation was accepted. Now, a curious idea had befogged Lohitcha's mind, namely that a samana or brahmana who had realized some good state of mind should not tell anyone else about it, because the desire to tell others is a form of lust. And what can one man do for another? After the meal, the Buddha questioned Lohitcha and pointed out that by not speaking to others who depended on him for their welfare, his inconsiderateness would make his heart stand fast in enmity, not in love, which would result in unsound doctrine. It's a very interesting point there, that if somebody who is a teacher teaches with his heart set, not set in love, then he will propound unsound doctrine. In spite of this, Lohitcha would continue to enjoy the revenue from all his flock in his domain. Furthermore, he would put obstacles in the way of those who had taken upon themselves the doctrine and the discipline set forth by him who had won the truth, namely himself, the Buddha. Having disabused Lohitcha's mind of his curious idea, the Buddha proceeded to point out three sorts of teachers in the world who are blameworthy. The description given in the sutta itself is a longish description, but briefly it amounts to this. First, there is the teacher who has not realized the truth, that is, made it completely real for himself through his own enlightenment. He teaches a Dhamma to his hearers, saying, "This is good for you, this will make you happy." His hearers do not listen to him, reject his teaching, and go their own way, saying to him, "You are like one who makes advances to her who keeps repulsing him and turns away from him." Second, the unrealized teacher, whose disciples listen to him, become steadfast in heart by their understanding of his teaching, and go not their different way. This teacher is like a man who weeds out his neighbor's field but neglects his own. Third, the teacher is one who has realized the truth, but his hearers do not listen and go their way apart from him. All three kinds of teachers are moved by a lust to set up or to pose as teachers, and are therefore blameworthy. 40 years ago, pondering on this exposition of the Buddha, I decided to refrain from regarding myself as a teacher of the scriptures and of the brahmacharya, the holy life. It happened to be one of my ambitions, if you like, in those immature days. I remain a fellow student of all truth seekers and a simple servant of those who wish to hear what little I have learned and seen for myself. All the perfected holy ones affirmed finality for the truth they realized and imparted to others. I claim no finality. Like Sanang Kumara of the Buddhists, which is the same as Sanat Kumara of the Hindus, the eternal youth, I am the Sanang Sekha, the constant learner. I try to learn from everyone and everything. The Brahman Lohitcha then asks the Buddha, what sort of a man is the blameless teacher? The Buddha replies that there is such a teacher in the world and gives a full description of him. As you may guess, the description of the blameless teacher fits no other than the Buddha himself and his great disciples who were arahants. These teachers, the holy ones, had perfect morality and confidence of heart, poise and equanimity, transcendental virtue and unerring insight, various supernormal powers, and the realization of truth and a clear vision of the law of the universe. How then could I claim or dare to accept the title of teacher where the holy life is concerned? So please do not think that it is mere modesty which makes me disclaim being a teacher. It is a fact. Whereas it is wise to refrain from arrogating to oneself the title of teacher, it is also wise to share with sincere inquirers that which one sees for oneself. Indeed, it is necessary to do so, for by sharing we can consider together, cooperatively and not argumentatively, the nature, meaning and significance of our daily living process, and consider it in a friendly and harmonious manner, like milk and water blending, regarding each other with the eye of affection. If there is no love between two people, they can't convey something worthwhile and real to each other. A few moments earlier, I used the phrase clear vision of the law of the universe. Prior to the emergence of this vision, animism prevailed in the religious beliefs and practice of the Indo-European peoples inhabiting the steppe lands of the Ukraine and Central Asia. A sizable group of these Indo-European people, speaking a language which is now lost, from which are descended most of the modern languages of Europe and India, were on the move away from their homeland, driven by climatic conditions, locusts, hostile tribes, and drought. Some of these tribes, in the course of a single year, would have to migrate 1,000 miles away from their particular homeland as such, and return to it when the season was right. This group went southwards at first, but split into two groups in course of time. One went westwards to Haroyu, the old name for the modern town of Herat in Afghanistan, and thence into Iran. The other went eastwards to Kabul, and thence to the Punjab, the land of the five rivers. Ab is a river, Panj five, Punjab, not Punjab. It is Punjab. The Irano-Aryans developed the idea of the rule of law, the divine law which prevailed throughout the universe, both spiritual and material. They named it Asha, A-S-H-A, Asha, a word which went through various transformations, Arsh, Eresh, Artha, Eretta. This last is clearly the Avastan equivalent of the Indo-Aryan Vedic word Ritha, the law which was order, cosmic order, moral order, the right. This conception must have been in use before the separation of the Irano-Aryans from the Indo-Aryans. So, the idea was probably in existence in the third millennium before Christ. This was the time when the Stone Age was changing to the Bronze Age. Zarathustra laid the greatest emphasis on Asha, the law. The Rig Veda exalted Rigta, which was their word for Asha. The gods were seen as sons of holy order, upholders of Rigta. Almost a millennium after Zarathustra, the Buddha upheld the unqualified suzerainty of the law and totally rejected animism. The law was higher than all the gods of the Vedic system. The gods experienced a partial Gatardamarung, but the majority of Hindus saved the celestial clan from extinction and have preserved their pantheon to this day. The power and importance of the law, the Dhamma, are well illustrated in the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta. The Exalted One, whilst staying at Mathula, addressed a small group of monks, only 20 of them according to the commentary on the sutta, as follows: Live ye as islands unto yourselves, as refuges unto yourselves, taking no other as refuge. Live with the Dhamma as your light, with the Dhamma as your refuge, taking no other as your refuge. And how does a monk live in that way? And the Buddha explains, herein, with respect to the body, the feelings, the mind, and mental states, kaya, vedana, citta, dhamma, dhamma, not dhamma, but dhamma, mental states. A monk continues to regard them in such a manner that he remains ardent, self-possessed, and mindful, so that he may overcome both the hankering and the dejection common in the world. Thus does a monk live as a lamp unto himself, with the Dhamma as his refuge, taking no other as his refuge. Now this teaching is presented in detail in other suttas, such as the Mahasatipatthana and the Mahaparinibbana. It involves the four basic truths of Buddhism: man's thirst for sensuous gratification, his passion to assert the self at the expense of the not-self, and his inordinate pleasure drive, all resulting in dukkha, the ill state. How shall man heal himself? Only by living according to the Dhamma, the law. The Buddha's opening words at the beginning of this sutta, the Chakravarti Sihanada, indicate the skillful art of living according to the Dhamma. The practical technique of this art consists in treading the Noble Eightfold Way. the great law governing the universal process and the life of man is the law of karma. In Iran, Zarathustra enunciated this in his gathas. I'll quote, give you two quotations. Age-long suffering for the followers of falsehood, but a fuller, higher life for the upholders of truth. And the next, thou referring to Ahura Mazda, the Supreme Being, thou hast ordained through thy wisdom that all deeds and words shall bear fruit, evil to the evildoer, good blessings to him who does good. Till the end of time. It's rather interesting. He spoke of it as end of time because Zarathustra was the first teacher to propound the doctrine of resurrection. It's very interesting if you study the whole teaching as such. To those who offer obedience and reverence to Mazda's holy word, Mazda is the other half of the name of Ahura Mazda. Mazda means wisdom. Very interesting to see how wisdom plays such an important part in Zarathustrianism, in Buddhism, and in so many other religious teachings. To those who offer obedience and reverence to Mazda's holy word shall come perfection and immortality, and also Ahura Mazda himself. In Zarathustra's presentation of karma, God the Supreme Being is both the lawgiver and the dispenser of justice. In the development of the idea of karma in the course of many centuries in India, the vision of the law as a self-administering impersonal law without requiring gods or a supreme god to act as justiciar came into being with the Buddha. Indeed, this law was the power to which all the gods were subject. Now, the word translated into English as gods is devas, deva, the shining ones from div. This law, whether we call it Asha of the Zarathustrians, or Rita of the Rig Veda, or Karma of the Hindus and Jains and Buddhists, or the commandments of the Hebrews, is inherent in all creation. This is where I differ from the usual presentation of karma. You did this, therefore you'll get that in return. I think that's all utterly nonsensical. Inherent in everything is the consequence of what happens, the natural consequence. It is the motive power in the entire universal process urging it towards that one far-off divine event towards which the whole creation moves, as Tennyson wrote in the last lines of his In Memoriam. This law is not a compulsion imposed by any supreme being or external power. It is inherent in everyone and in everything. Through the millennia, we have had only a limited understanding of karma and indeed of almost everything. Despite a few million years of evolution and all our mental and cultural development, we are still separatively and isolatively conscious of ourselves and of everything. The world society and our entire system of social justice is based upon and vitiated by our basic misconception of ourselves as separate individuals. We are, therefore, the slaves of our ideas of reward and punishment, action and reaction, cause and effect, where karma is concerned. Since we are still subhuman, we are not clearly conscious. And please remember, I do not use the word subhuman pejoratively at all. I use it in the sense that the members of the human race have not yet arrived at their culmination as full-fledged humans. The word human really means a blissful creator. And blissful creator is the way monotheistic religions have described God. All God conceptions are sort of distant visions of what man himself aspires to be. Karma means action. Fundamentally, it means the creative action in eternity which gives rise to, maintains, and constantly transforms all manifestation. Karma is not a rewarding or punishing process, a hell or heaven decreeing process. Reward, punishment, heaven, hell is our misperception due to our confinement in dualistic perceiving and to our subhuman ideas of justice. Karma is a whole-making, a healing process. I think Aristotle gave one of the best definitions of justice in his Nicomachean Ethics, Book 5, Chapter 2. Briefly, it is justice. Justice is the practice of perfect virtue to all and everyone and to oneself. It's very interesting. It's the practice of perfect virtue towards everyone and to oneself. The ordinary view of the working out of karma is somewhat as follows. Each person is responsible for his or her thought and feeling, word and deed. Therefore, to him or her will accrue, must accrue, the consequence here and now in this life or in a future life. This view involves the idea of the exclusive responsibility of each person. Is that so in actual fact? That each person is exclusively responsible for all his thinking and feeling, his speaking and his acting. Consider carefully. We know that the universe consists of countless interrelated and interactive particulars. Any action here affects the furthest star, as science knows. When a man performs an act, is not that act the result of a great many forces at play, such as his upbringing and education, the opinions, wishes, demands or commands of other people, the customs of his community, the compulsion of circumstance, etc., etc., in addition to his own desires, his own state of health or illness, his own abilities or defects, etc., etc. How then can we possibly say that any person is exclusively responsible. In actual fact, any deed affects not only the doer of the deed at the moment of performing that action, but also affects the whole environment, which in turn affects the doer. Karma is indeed a holistic process. We talk of justice and of divine justice. Our idea of justice is a puerile, tit-for-tat justice. And the human race has been stupid enough to ascribe just that sort of justice to God, to karma. Not God, not karma invented heaven and hell. Savage, imperfect, and unenlightened man invented hell to satisfy his destructive passion for revenge. And greedy man invented heaven to satisfy his inordinate lust for endless pleasure. Generally speaking, that which we dislike or which hurts us, we call evil or hellish. And that which pleases us, we call good or heavenly. Karma works out immediately. Since the totality is involved in this working, and since the totality consists of countless particulars which are continually changing, the karmic process is exceedingly complex. It is impossible to work out or follow the details of the process in even a very limited context. We may reasonably generalize and say the totality sows and the totality reaps. But to apportion out cause and effect with respect to any particular person is impossible, except in certain minor ways. Strong emotion, for example, gives rise to chemical reactions in the body itself and affects the person. That is just one example out of several such examples. The karmic process is better understood in terms of this is how it happens, and not of you or I deserved or did not deserve this. Fire burns. That is its nature. If I put my finger in it deliberately or unknowingly, I will be hurt horribly. If I want to test the law of gravity by stepping over Beachy Head, whether I'm a sinner or a saint, the result will be the identical result. You see, I shall be remembered as a first-class fool. Put a metal poker into the fire, and it will only get red hot or melt. The nature of the living body is such that the painful result is inevitable unless other forces powerful enough to prevent it are brought to bear upon it. If we can holistically understand karma and its workings, virtues such as compassion, generosity, patience, and forbearance can find expression. Seeing the world's pain, illness, grief, folly, and danger, we cannot but feel compassion. Prior to feeling compassion, we are likely to be critical, especially if we are intellectually perceptive, and say to those in suffering, "What can you expect? if you live the sort of life you do, self-indulgent and self-serving. And if we have a streak of cruelty in our nature, we may say, serve you right, which also betrays our own self-righteousness. But should we be free of separativeness, we would feel the world's suffering, folly and evil doing as our own suffering, folly and evil doing. Then we suffer with whoever is in suffering, whatever may be the cause of that suffering. This is compassion, suffering in sympathy with, suffering out of love for the fool, the ignorant one, the deliberately criminal one. Compassion can move us to give generously of money, food, advice, services, and protection where needed. Let such giving be without any calculation. Then it will be free of any karmic bond, free of a creditor-debtor relationship. Whatever is freely given with love, including love itself, has healing and joy-giving power for both the giver and the recipient of the gift. Patience and forbearance are necessary when some of the early consequences of doing good recoil against us. We all know how perplexed we are when we see a benefactor made to suffer pain or obloquy when he has benefited someone or his whole community. Some of the norms of society need to be changed if it is to progress in line with the developmental trend mentally and spiritually. If you, the individual, see the direction in which there should be change and bend your energies to bring it about, you will be in conflict with society, because society tends to stay put. Society being the bigger and stronger unit, you are the one who is likely to be hurt for doing good to it. Should you have the requisite stamina and endurance and patience and forbearance, and your vision is truly in advance of society and its norms, the change will take place in due time. Society will be better off, but at the cost of your suffering. Such is vicarious atonement. So many people rebel against the idea of vicarious atonement. But read Suzuki's introduction to his translation of the Lankavatara Sutta, and you'll see what he says about vicarious atonement in Mahayana Buddhism. Each psychophysical organism is the containment of all karmic energies, one's own action process as well as the universal action process. If there were no constantly active external world, there would be no you, no me. So, you are your karma. I am my karma. Like you, I am in ceaseless interplay with the totality. each one of us is his or her brother's or sister's keeper. In fact, the keeper of the totality, responsible for all its aspects and actions, whether good or bad, virtuous or vicious. If we can see this, we can understand how and why the world's scriptures say that all nature, the whole creation, rejoices at the birth of the Holy One, at his enlightenment, or his union with the Supreme. And since the Holy One's consciousness can function holistically in terms of infinity and eternity, it is said of the Buddha that on waking up each morning, he looked over the whole world with the eye of a Buddha and poured out help where help was needed. The Holy Ones are clearly conscious of their intimate interrelationship and karmic responsibility with and for all mankind. Hence, the immense sphere for the exercise of their transcendental wisdom and compassion. Hence also the Buddha's statement of the world tragedy in his fire sermon at Gaya Head. Everything is burning, burning with the fire of passion, of lust, of hatred, and of stupidity. The Buddha derived all evil things, all vicious things from those three. As said earlier, karma means action. There is action which is creative action in eternity. It is free action, constant, transcendent karma, which entails no consequence and is without beginning or ending, that is, birth or death. Remember Sri Krishna's words in one of the cantos of the Gita, Arjuna, if I did not constantly engage in action, all these worlds would fall into ruin. That action is creative action in eternity. We can't picture it. I certainly can't picture it. But I think what I'm saying is true. Desire plays no part in that creative action. And there is another kind of action which entails consequence, namely a desired existential universe which comes into being at a partial cost of the absoluteness of the freedom of creative action in eternity. Here there is beginning and ending, birth and death and bondage. Finitude and temporality have intruded upon infinity and eternity. The original transcendent karmic law now operates in a karmic discriminative universe, characterized by ceaseless change, duality and multiplicity, and attraction and repulsion, with attachment and aversion as their psychical counterparts. Bondage for us is due to attachment, with its associated me and mine and the vijnanic consciousness of isolated, separative selfhood, Vijnanic consciousness is analytic, discriminative, differentiating all the time. It is not holistic consciousness. Death is the instrument of freedom here, because once the existential being is dead, that's the complete death of him as an existential being. For that being, with which most of us associate our idea of self, me, you, he, she, and so on, the death of the existential being is a complete death. There is no possible return for that. There is no reincarnation or rebirth for that existential consciousness and existential being. Rebirth is here and now, whilst you are alive. It is one of the purposes of our existence to realize freedom through dying whilst we are alive. Sounds a strange statement. But the fact of the matter is that every split second of our existence is a process of dying to the previous state and emerging into the new state. You die to your previous condition in order that the new may come into being. Take a newborn infant. It grows, and we are so anxious that it should grow. But every second that it grows, it has died to what it was in the previous second. Isn't that so? That's a physical fact. This realization of freedom can be done by totally abandoning everything that makes for coherent, particular manifestation. We hold on to what is actually present. We are incorrigible conservatives in some way or other. This abandoning spells the death of all attachment. Such death, whilst you are alive, sets you free, prepares the way, and enables love to function. Love needs the context of complete freedom for its proper functioning. Free love not as defined by the whole world. Pure and true love is associated with unity and universality in holistic consciousness, and with the complete absence of me, mine, and I, which is the meaningful and right realization of anatta. When we are totally free of the sense of me, mine, and I, then that is the anatta that the Buddha really talked of, I would say. Because time and again, if you look through the discourses very, very carefully, you will see how the atta in the sense of the Upanishadic Atman is implied, definitely implied. Death and love are ever together in intimate relationship. Death sets you free. That is, your abandonment frees you from all binding attachment. Love releases your consciousness into profounder states, nearer to enlightenment, nearer to the void, the emptiness which is the transparent clarity where there is no evil. Making the mind void is a phrase which has been used. I prefer to say, you make the psyche void. mind is a universal archetypal form through which the primordial creative energy functions. When it comes into contact with the body, it gives rise to psyche. The psyche has its roots in the brain and nervous system, is subject to the activity of the ductless glands, the flow of the bloodstream, and the condition of the body generally. And that is the determines your, not so much determines, is the instrument through which your intellectual and emotional life, your thoughts and feelings and so on, manifest. That is psyche. I would never call it mind, because mind is transcendent. It is not particular. It's like space, for instance. Here is space, we say. Can you cut off slabs of the space in this room and appropriate a slab for yourself, stick your nameplate on it? It's totally impossible. You see? So that which is transcendent, that which belongs to the context of infinity and eternity, can never be possessed by anyone. I go much further and say that the whole of transcendence, the whole of infinity, all of eternity is completely and totally embodied in each and every particular throughout the entire universe. We can't be conscious of it, we can't visualize it, we can't imagine it. But this is something which I can only affirm, that's all. Take it or leave it as you please. The supreme abandonment is your conscious, utterly peaceful abandonment of your own existential being. That is, the relinquishment of your psychophysical organism. Study carefully and meditate deeply on the account of the death of the Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Study that very, very carefully, with the mind, with the brain as quiet as possible. Because if the brain isn't quiet, all the conditioning of the brain and all our petty little concepts and ideas will interfere with what inspiration might emerge. So let the brain be as quiet as possible. Stop talking, as the schoolmaster says to the class. Here are the words of the Buddha in the Anangiyasappaya Sutta. Ananda, O a monk who is without grasping, attains final Nibbana. I would quarrel with that word attains, although it is attributed to no less a person than the Buddha. You never attain or achieve that which is transcendent. You, who are the particular limited manifestation, grow in such a manner that you become the totality, the absolute all. That takes you up into itself. You know, there's a very interesting sentence in the New Testament, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. That's the kind of thing that actually happens. I say so, but don't believe a word of what I say. Don't reject it out of hand either. Consider it. Consider it. And again, the Buddha says in that same sutta, this is deathlessness, the deliverance of heart without grasping. Amatam yadidam anupada chittasa vimokha.